Peter Mawson. Sunday morning. 14th of December, 2014. Luke chapter 8, verse 40, to Luke chapter 8, verse 56.
To the passage that was read only a few moments ago, it's page 1038 in the Church Bibles, and it's Luke's Gospel in chapter 8. Isn't it odd, the things that you remember that go back, in my case, decades? I remember when I was a very small child, I can't remember exactly how old, but I must have been perhaps 5 or 6. I remember going with my grandmother, who used to look after me in the day, because my mum and dad had to work, as most people did in those days. And I was with her, and she took me to the shop across the road. And it was one of these sort of multi-purpose shops, just a little shop with an elderly lady, I remember, who worked there. And it sold all sorts of food stuff, but mostly sweets, except at the other end of the counter, it sold paraffin. Now, this was an odd combination because it gave a very strange flavour to almost everything that you bought out of that shop. I mean, it just wouldn't be allowed these days. But there you are, paraffin one end, sweets the other. And why I remember is because I was standing holding the hand of my grandmother as she was purchasing something when a policeman came in and bought sweets. I was horrified. In fact, I was terrified, because I was really afraid of policemen. Mainly because my grandmother used to say, if you don't behave yourself, I'm going to call a policeman. Now, if I'd have had any common sense, I'd have realised this can't possibly be true, otherwise there'd have been a policeman knocking on my door every couple of hours. But there never was. But that's what I thought. I thought these policemen, I mean, they're men of immense authority, they're terrifying. But there he was, in all his uniform and his big hat in those days, buying sweets. And I couldn't sort of put it together. But of course, as I grew up in the 50s and 60s, it was a time, wasn't it, many of you remember, when people in authority were being questioned. The whole business of authority was being questioned, wasn't it? And people were asking, well, what kind of authority have you got? And who says you have that authority? And it was becoming a time of tremendous social change. So that today, as we sit here, you know and I know, that we have a very dim view of authority and very little respect for people who once we would have seen as people with authority. We have little respect for the police. We seem to have little respect, certainly, for teachers, for politicians, and even for our royal family. They're all in for a dig, really. In fact, we live in an age now where anyone who has or seems to have authority or claims authority is immediately viewed with immense suspicion. That's the case, isn't it? The problem we have, therefore, when we open our Bibles, and as we have been doing as we have gone through the Gospel of Luke, is that almost immediately on every page, we are confronted with the authority of the man Jesus. He is a man who just seems to have this tremendous authority over everything and everyone. In fact, it's true to say that on every page of Luke's Gospel and all the other Gospels and the whole of the New Testament, the personality of Jesus just towers above everything, doesn't it? And it is this man that we are called to have faith in. We're called to believe in him and to have faith in this man. But the question that I would ask, if I were you, is what is this faith? Just how is it to be expressed? Just what is it? We've had sort of examples, really, of the whole business of faith. Do you remember the end of the parable of the sower, as the NIV, our Bibles, call it? It says this, but the seed on good soil stands for those with a noble and good heart who hear the word, retain it, and persevering produce a crop. That is basically a description of a person, a man or a woman of faith, someone with a noble and good heart who hears the word, retains it, and by persevering produces a crop. And in our story that we've read today, there are two examples of faith. Jesus says to this woman who has been healed, verse 48 of chapter 8, Jesus says to her, "Daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace." And then in verse 50, we have another example of Jesus commending faith. He says, Jesus said to Jairus, "Don't be afraid, just believe." So there is the commendation for us to have faith in this man, Jesus. But what is it? Just what is this faith that we have brought before us? Well, it's a focused faith. That's the first thing I want to bring to you this morning. It is focused. Can I just say, as we come to the end of chapter 8, that chapter 8, I don't know whether you've noticed, because we've spent several weeks over it, and I would commend it to you as a chapter to read from beginning to end, if you can, rather than having breaks in it. It is a remarkable chapter. It is a chapter which consists of four separate miracles, extraordinary miracles. It's also significant that we are now, at the end of chapter 8, a third of the way through Luke's gospel. And it's as though, having arrived at a third of the way through, Luke stops and says, "Now, I want you to examine the evidence again about this man Jesus. I want you to pause for a moment or two, and I want you to look at this chapter, and I want you to think about it, and I want you to look at the evidence and think about this man Jesus. What is there to be said about him?" Well, what we need to know about him in this gospel is these remarkable miracles that Jesus performs. Can I just take you back one step to verse 22, where we have Jesus calming the storm? We're told in the middle of a storm, his disciples are terrified. Jesus gets up in the boat, rebukes the wind and the raging waters. The storm subsided and all was calm. And Jesus asked the fateful question, "Where is your faith?" So Jesus, with a word, stops the storm in its tracks. And then we had this business of this demon-possessed man that we looked at last week, this very difficult section, this man who is raving, "What do you want with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God?" He cries out, "I beg you, don't torture me." And verse 29, "For Jesus had commanded the impure spirit to come out of the man." And that is what happens. We are given that evidence later on when we read that they see this man dressed and in his right mind sitting at Jesus' feet. And then we have these two miracles in front of us. We have this sick lady who is immediately healed. We're told in verse 44, she came up behind Jesus, touched the edge of his cloak, and immediately her bleeding stopped. And we have the raising of Jairus' daughter from the dead. Verse 54, "But Jesus took her by the hand and said, 'My child, get up.' And her spirit returned, and at once she stood up." What are we to make of this? They're put here in front of us as simple fact. And what we have to say by conclusion is, these are extraordinary in any sense of the term. They are not something that we can replicate humanly. What happened here is extraordinary, beyond our ability. In fact, it's beyond our explanation. It is beyond our comprehension what Jesus was able to do. But more than that, it's beyond what modern science could explain. How can a man stop a storm dead in its tracks? How can a man raise this little girl from the dead? It is beyond human scientific understanding and thought. We cannot explain it. Why is it presented to us in this way? Why is it that we have these four extraordinary miracles, one after the other? I mean, if there was anything that would cause an atheist here this morning to doubt the Bible, it's those four miracles. But they're there because they happened. Luke, remember, is writing history. He's not making this up. This is all remembered. This is all stuff that he's checked out. Now, why is it there? It is there because he is announcing as loudly as he can to us this morning that actually these miracles are beyond human ability.
These miracles could only occur because God does them. They are events which only God himself can perform. Isn't that right? These are God things. They're not human. So what's the point of that? Well, let me tell you, it is telling us something about Jesus, which I want to drive home this morning. I want to drive it home because that's what Luke's doing. That's what he's doing. He's driving something home to us this morning. And here it is. Do you remember, let me remind you, that the disciples in the midst of this storm, in this little boat, seeing Jesus calm the wind and the waves with a word, they ask a question. Who is this? He commands even the winds and the water, and they obey him. And I drew your attention to the end of the next passage, which we looked at last week, this man occupied by demons who is healed. Jesus says to him, verse 39 of this chapter, return home and tell how much God has done for you. So the man went away and told all over the town how much Jesus had done for him. Jesus says, tell them how God has worked in your life. So he goes home and he tells them how Jesus has done this work in his life. Do you get the point? Luke wants you to get the point. He is saying to you this morning that this man standing here is God. This is God. He is Jesus, but he is God. He is Jesus, but he is the Son of God. He is announcing a third of the way through the gospel. He is announcing in the clearest possible terms so far the deity of Jesus Christ. And he wants us to see that we need to have faith in this man who is God. We need to see his towering majesty and authority and power and to put our trust just in him, in no one else. We live in a world which says, look, you can believe what you like. As long as you believe it sincerely, that's fine. Jesus says that's nonsense. He is calling us to have faith in one person only, and it is in him, the Son of God. It has to be a focused faith, and the focus is entirely upon the person of Jesus Christ. And our second point is really going on from that, because we haven't actually explained what it is yet. We've talked about faith and we've said where it ought to be focused, but what is it? Well, Luke is explaining it to us. He's actually illustrating it in our story in front of us this morning. Now, you don't need me to tell you, which is my way of saying I'm going to tell you, that actually we all express faith, don't we? Every day, almost every hour of the day, we have a certain amount of faith. We have faith when we get on the bus that the driver knows where he's going and he's going to get us to the destination. When we get on an aeroplane, we have faith that the pilot is capable, that he's passed an exam or two, and he's going to be able to take off, and hopefully he's going to be able to land this thing as well. We have faith in the pilot. Sometimes it's misplaced faith, as it was recently when they found a pilot who apparently was allegedly over the limit, which is slightly scary. Presumably he was going to land the plane sideways or something. But anyway, they managed to see that. But that's a rare event. Why? Because we have faith in these people, that they know what they're doing. We have faith when we sat down this morning that the chair that you're sitting on isn't going to give way underneath you. We do this all the time. And that's very ordinary, isn't it? It's every day. It's our faith that we have in everyday things. It's a sort of probabilities that it's going to work. This is clearly something else. Jesus says to this lady, your faith has healed you. He says to Jairus, don't be afraid, just believe. There is something else about this belief, isn't there, which is more than common, that is not ordinary. It is sort of bigger subject than that. So what is it that Luke is illustrating about faith? It's interesting how much information, again, Luke gives us, isn't it, about Jairus. Well, firstly, we know his name. Don't you find that extraordinary, that the way that Luke just uses names all over the place about people? Why does he do that? Well, because it's true. That was his name. Luke is writing history. If he wasn't writing history, he'd have kept away from names. Because people have said, well, I was there. His name wasn't Jairus. There wasn't anybody around at that time. But Luke can write it with immense confidence because he's writing a bit of history. This is fact. This is not makeup. His name was Jairus. This is historical fact. And we're told about Jairus that he was a synagogue leader. So he was not a nobody. He was a powerful man in his town. A man who led the synagogue had a lot of authority. In fact, remember that a lot of the opposition to Jesus came from the synagogue people. It came from the religious leaders. It came from people like Jairus, who had authority over towns as far as their religion was concerned. But that was a powerful thing. It was a big, powerful authority that Jairus had. But Jairus had a very sick daughter, a girl of about 12, who, we are told, was dying. So he comes to Jesus and fell at Jesus' feet, pleading with him to come to his house. That's Jairus. And intriguingly, the way Luke writes this story, he weaves in another story, which is quite unusual, really. And this is this woman here, this very sick woman in verse 43. A woman was there who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years, but no one could heal her. Notice that. See, Luke as a doctor would have taken note of that, wouldn't he? No one could heal her. Here's a woman who had been as ill for as long as Jairus' daughter had lived. She'd lived for 12 years. She'd been sick for 12 years. So she was very sick. And we're told in the margin, if you have a little look at the margin, that some of the manuscripts say that she had spent all she had on doctors. Well, you can understand that. For 12 years, she'd been desperate to get healing. So she'd spent every penny that she had on getting healing, all to no avail. No one could heal her. So this woman was not just very sick, but she was also probably pretty destitute by then. She was a poor lady. We're talking to somebody really at the other end of the spectrum of society, aren't we? Here's Jairus, and here is this woman who isn't even named in this case. But there's something else about this woman which we need to understand. The fact and nature of her illness meant that she was outside of society. She was really, in all intents and purposes, a pariah. You see, a woman suffering as she was could not go to the synagogue to worship. She could not go for certain to the great temple in Jerusalem to worship. It was forbidden. She couldn't even mix with her neighbors and with her friends. That wasn't allowed. So she could not go down into the marketplace and just rub shoulders with people, because her illness meant that religiously she was unclean. It's hard for us to understand that, but we've come across it before, haven't we, in the gospel. She was just viewed as religiously unclean. It was like a contagion. If she had touched someone, they became unclean, and then they couldn't go to the temple in the synagogue. That's what it was like. It was like she was a leper, and she was pretty well would have been treated that way. Why do you think that she came up behind Jesus and touched the edge of his cloak? Why is it, do you think, that when Jesus begins to draw her out, she comes trembling to fall at his feet? It is important to understand how she felt about Jesus. We'll come back to that. But it's because she knew that the crowd could turn on her, because she shouldn't have been there. She shouldn't have been in the midst of the crowd. She shouldn't have had anything to do with the crowd, because she was making everyone she touched unclean. So she was terrified. So we have two people at different ends of the social spectrum. Jairus, this powerful religious leader, and this poor woman who is basically a nobody in the town. But there's something that unites them, and that is their desperate need. Jairus' daughter is dying. This woman has been sick almost as long as she can remember, for 12 years. And no one can meet her need. And so they come to Jesus. And what is so interesting is that the way they come is identical. Verse 41, a man named Jairus, a synagogue leader, came and fell at Jesus' feet, pleading with him to come to his house. She comes up behind him and just touches the edge of his cloak. And then we read in verse 47, the woman, seeing that she could not go unnoticed, she knew that Jesus knew that she knew. She comes trembling and fell at his feet. Luke never wastes a word or a phrase. Have you noticed how often that phrase, falling at his feet, occurs? It happens 3 times in this chapter alone. What is it we read about the demon-possessed man in verse 28? When he saw Jesus, he cried out and fell at his feet, shouting at the top of his voice, "What do you want with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God?" He falls at the feet of Jesus. Here are people in deep humility. They know that they have to bow to this man, Jesus. And in humility, they come to him in their need. And Jesus instantly responds. For the demon-possessed man, the demons are cast out at a word. For the woman, her bleeding stops immediately. And for Jairus' daughter, who by now is dead. We read in verse 44, Jesus took her by the hand and said, "My child, get up." Her spirit returned, and at once she stood up. Then Jesus told them to give her something to eat. What Jesus did is what every parent here has done more than once. What is that? Well, you have actually gone into the bedroom of your young child and said, "It's time to get up. It's school time. Up you get. Joe, Bill, Anne, get up." That is the idiom Jesus used. He just said, "Get up, my child. It's time to get up." And she does. So not only are we seeing in these 4 miracles the great majesty, the deity of Jesus, but here we see his compassion and his love, his grace, his tenderness, and his kindness. And when you come, knowing your need, in humility, you and I can know that too. But there's something else here, and that is fruitful faith. Have you noticed in this passage, or in this chapter really, all the different people that we are confronted with? We're confronted with the disciples in the raging sea, and they're disciples who have fear and amazement. "Who is this?" they say. He commands even the winds and the water, and they obey him. And then we came across the townspeople of the demon-possessed man. Verse 37, then all the people of the region of the Gerasenes asked Jesus to leave them because they were overcome with fear. So he got into the boat and left. And then verse 40, we come across another crowd. Now when Jesus returned across the lake, a crowd welcomed him, for they were all expecting him. And it was quite a crowd, wasn't it? Look at verse 42. As Jesus was on his way, the crowds almost crushed him. It was such a group of people that they were swamping him. They were overwhelming him with their pressure. So there was quite a crowd. And then we have this rather bizarre group of people around the house of Jairus. Verse 52, when Jesus gets there, meanwhile, all the people were wailing and mourning for her. They were just doing what they do in the Middle East. And as you know, they paid people to do that. So there was a great deal of hullabaloo in the house and around the house because of the death of Jairus' daughter. There was this mourning. But isn't it a bizarre moment? Because Jesus says, stop wailing. She is not dead, but asleep. And they laughed at him, knowing that she was dead. Don't you think that's odd? I mean, one minute they're crying their eyes out, and the next minute they're laughing at him. It's really weird, isn't it? There's that sort of oddness about it. But this is the situation. So there's all these people that we are confronted with in chapter 8, and yet none of them, for Luke, seem to matter. None of them. The people that matter are Jairus and the unnamed woman. They're the ones who take center stage, don't they? And the demon-possessed man, of course. But in our story, just those two people is what are brought to us as being most important. Why is that? Because of their faith in Jesus. That's why. But don't run away with the idea that they had tremendous faith. Sometimes we talk about that, don't we? We say, oh, we meet people and they say to us, oh, I wish I had your faith. As though, you know, it's something extraordinary that we have this immense faith that governs our lives. Well, Christians here know it isn't quite like that, is it? Our faith is as lumpy as anyone and fluctuates. So this couple are not brought to us as people of tremendous faith, that somehow we've got to reach the limits of their faith. You could easily read that, because Jesus says to this woman in verse 48, daughter, your faith has healed you, go in peace. As though somehow she's reached a pinnacle of faith and that's brought healing. That's a mistake. That isn't what Jesus is saying. That's obvious from the rest of the story. These two people didn't know very much about Jesus. They couldn't have done. They did not know the answer to all the questions that they would have had and that you and I have. They did not understand everything about Jesus, but they knew enough. That is the point. They knew enough about Jesus to come to him. They knew that somehow this man was extraordinary and that he could meet their deepest need. And so they come to him, but they come, notice, with such humility. They come not expecting or not demanding really anything, that Jesus doesn't owe them anything. But they come to him hoping for everything. And Jesus never disappoints people who come like that. Is that you this morning? You may not know everything. Well, join the club. You may not understand all there is to know about Jesus. But if you know that you have a need this morning, and that need reaches into the very center of your life, into the depths of your heart, and there is no answer for it in this world, and you know that in your heart there is a compulsion that Jesus can bring an answer, that he is the one who can bring cleansing and forgiveness and healing and hope to you, then you come to him and he will not disappoint. Well, let me just say something here as we close. We live in an age where, you know, you're allowed to believe, but you're not allowed really to share what you believe. It's okay to believe as long as you keep it to yourself. Keep it private. It's not something that you should talk about in the public square, at work or at home, certainly not in politics. You know, it's okay. If you believe in your own front room, but don't bring it out here and talk about it. The reality is, for those who have faith in Jesus, that is not an option.
Is it?
It's not an option. And that is brought out in these stories. For this man who was healed of this demon possession, Jesus speaks to him specifically and says, return home and tell how much God has done for you. Tell them. So the man went away and told all over the town how much Jesus had done for him. And for Jairus and for this lady wanted to keep it all quiet. She wanted to arrive and then disappear. Of course she did, but she isn't allowed to do that. Verse 47, then the woman, seeing that she could not go unnoticed, came trembling and fell at his feet in the presence of all the people. She told why she had touched him and how she had been instantly healed. She goes public. She has no choice. She must speak to the crowd about what has happened to her. And Jairus, well, he's told his mom, his daughter, mom and dad, are told not to spread this around. Verse 56, her parents were astonished, but he ordered them not to tell anyone what had happened. He doesn't want, you see, Jesus doesn't want this to become such a thing that he has no room to preach the gospel. So he wants to keep a lid on it. But of course, everybody knows anyway. In the town, they would know what had happened to Jairus' daughter. But he's trying to keep a lid on the enthusiasm because it's hindering his ministry. But you see, Jairus has already gone public. I wonder how often Jairus, as the synagogue leader, had found himself in the street, lying in the dust, in front of anybody. Answer? Never. But with Jesus, it's all public. He lies there in front of Christ, in front of the town. This is public. His faith, his trust in this man is a public thing. And that is what we are called to. We have no option. If we have faith in this Christ, we cannot keep it private. We must tell others. That's what Jesus is saying to us. That's what Luke is demonstrating in this chapter. Of course, we do it in ordinary ways, if you like. We do it every time we take communion here, in the, as we will next Sunday. We are announcing to the world, as well as to one another, as well as to the Lord, that we love him and we trust him. And we're following him. That's what we do when we take communion. We do that when we baptize people. That is the great way of announcing to a world that we love Christ and we're living for him and we're going to go his way. That's what baptism is. But it's also in our daily lives as we speak to men and women and boys and girls and our neighbors and friends and family who don't yet know Christ, and we call them to follow this man, the Son of God, who has saved us in his mercy. Amen. We're going to close as we sing.